What would you be willing to pay for better local drinking water? The results of a new study just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a nice weekend. We're always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download our WJCT app and listen anytime. You can also listen to the show right now on our Facebook page. Just ahead, a look at one study evaluating Jacksonville's drinking water and how much you would all be willing to pay to improve it. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, local author Trisha Booker plus Cole Pepper as March Madness heats up. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's not well known to most Americans, but a surprising number of U.S. cities have drinking water with unhealthy levels of chemicals and contaminants. And that includes our area, too. In fact, Jacksonville is ranked among the worst in water quality, according to the Environmental Working Group. Now, the EWG examined the quality of water supplies in a large group of major American cities between the years 2005 and 2009. That study's been out for a while. Here's what's new. A group of professors at UNF looked at this problem by investigating how much local residents might be willing to pay for improvement in the quality of our water. At the same time, JEA last year, the local utility, released a water quality report, and there's a lot of information there as well. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at all of this as we welcome both JEA and the study authors. Here in studio, Kevin Holbrooks, JEA, Director of Laboratory Compliance. Good morning.
Good morning.
And the authors of the new UNF study, Dr. Chiradip Chatterjee. He's the principal investigator. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Russell Triplett. He's an assistant professor of economics at UNF.
Good morning.
And Dr. Parvez Ahmed, a professor of accounting and finance. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. How concerned are you about the quality of our local drinking water? Would you be willing to pay a little more money in the form of your tax dollars for better water? We want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Go online. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on our Facebook page. And in a moment, we'll hear from JEA about their water quality annual report that has been out for a little while now and is available online and at your local public library. But first, Dr. Chatterjee, let's begin with you. You are the principal investigator of this new study from UNF looking at willingness to pay, meaning how concerned are local residents about our water and would they be willing to pay more to improve it? What did the study find?
So let me first clarify that by no means I'm looking at the quality of the water. I'm not qualified to do that.
You're an economist, not a scientist.
Right. I'm not a chemist. All I can do, I can check whether the concern that people have for their quality of drinking water in terms of the tap water is genuine or not. So you may say that, you know, the concern that other people say that people might have regarding the tap water is fake, but I kind of trying to prove that it's not fake, because people are saying that we wanna pay a positive amount if someone can assure me that whatever concerns I have in terms of my drinking water that can be solved, and I can be back on the tap water for my drinking purpose, for my cooking purpose, and I don't have to spend money on water purifier, I don't have to spend money on bottled water. So basically, I'm ready to channel that money that I'm spending on other means towards improving the, I won't say quality, rather addressing my concerns that I have for the tap water quality. So that's what we're checking in this study.
Okay, and the Environmental Working Group found that there are multiple toxic chemicals in our water, along with an unpleasant odor in a lot of local tap water. That's a common complaint. So, Dr. Triplett, what's the willingness for local water users, which is all of us, to use their money or put their money toward improving this issue?
Let me share a few of our numbers with you from a survey that we conducted last spring in cooperation with the Public Opinion Research Lab at the University of North Florida. We asked residents about their attitudes and perceptions of the water. When we asked residents about whether they were concerned about getting sick from the tap water, roughly 31% indicated that they were concerned or very concerned about that issue. We asked respondents if their tap water had a foul smell or a foul taste. And there we had 32% of residents responding that they either somewhat agreed or strongly agreed with that statement. And finally, we asked folks, do you believe your tap water is in some way contaminated? And there again, we had something like 34% of folks who answered somewhat agree or strongly agree. We think this signifies a really strong perception within the community about the problems with the local tap water. And we think that's based on previous information and previous experience with the water quality.
So, Dr. Parvez Ahmed, with the ongoing issue of lead contamination in other cities' drinking water, the poster child for that is Flint, Michigan. How do you see this? Will this become an issue that is more important to local constituents?
It is already an issue that is important to local constituents. Of course, water is vital for our living. And it is not so much, as Chiradip and Russell has mentioned, we are not chemists, so we are not really directly commenting on the quality of water in Jacksonville. What we are commenting on is the perception that residents of Jacksonville have about water quality. And what our study shows is that there is a willingness by the residents that we surveyed to pay on average about $6 more on a monthly bill. So that they can get better, so that they can perceive that
$6 more per month. Okay.
So that's what we call the willingness to pay. Of course, there is a difference between a person's willingness to pay and what they will actually pay.
Of course, we
recognize that and we address that in the study. So just because residents say they're willing to pay this amount does not mean they will feel happy if JEA bills them that amount. But it actually strengthens JEA's and our local public policymakers' hand in trying to understand that there is a positive amount of money that that residents are willing to pay. They may not be willing to pay $6 a month. Maybe they're willing to pay $2 or $3 a month. If that addresses their perception, if you can improve the perception about water quality, then that is a win-win-win for everybody.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment. What are your thoughts and questions about the quality of our local drinking water on the First Coast? It's 549-2937. Kevin Holbrooks, JEA's Director of Laboratory Compliance, is here to talk about the utility's perspective on this and also your water quality annual report. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. We always appreciate the opportunity to come talk about water quality. As you said, there is a perception out there that we are always trying to tell people and reinforce that your drinking water is perfectly safe. We do over 45,000 analysis a year, testing it. It's tested on a daily, like almost minute-by-minute basis in some cases. The issue I think that comes about here is that taste and odor are very subjective. And it's like when you start peeling back the layers of an onion, it's easy to say, you know, what's your perception? But as you start tasting odor and everyone's got a different idea, it's very individual. Like my kids, sour gummy worms are their big things. I don't particularly like them. So, you know, but and another case in point is bottled water. There's many different varieties and everything out there. And I think that the study was, you know, would you drink tap water? There's a lot of things you can do with your tap water to make it taste better. If it doesn't taste good, I drink it right out of the tap. I don't have any issues with it.
So then in terms of the JEA's response to the Environmental Working Group study, do you dispute those findings?
Yeah, the Environmental Working Group study was a very biased report. Basically done, EWG, as they're known, as an environmental advocacy group. They're actually sponsored by water filter companies. If you go on their website, you'll see lots of advertising for water filter companies and everything. And the study was put together very hastily with what I would call public information. So if there was a lot of public information available, that got put in the study. Case in point is the average utility in the study had 420 samples reviewed and had an average of 8 detections, which was about 2% of their samples had detects in it, while JEA had over 6,900 samples reviewed and with only 23 detects, which is a 0.3%. So on an overall percentage basis, we're much better than the perceived, you know, bias to this study.
Okay. And lots of calls as we ask you, our listeners, would you be willing to pay up to $6 more a month for better drinking water? That's what a new UNF study has just found. Let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Mylon in Ponte Vedra. Mylon, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to discuss, do we have comparisons against other parts of the country, like New York, where water quality is better? There's a simple tester that you can get on Amazon, which shows that, the quality of water from New York, where I used to live, it's way better, the scale is massive compared to the water here in Jacksonville. Do you have, numbers against, comparisons against, parts of the country where the water quality is very good and internationally as well?
Sure. Thanks for that question. Is there a point of comparison? Dr. Chatterjee.
So definitely we don't have numbers to compare, but I just want to mention something that I think is very important. The thing is what he said, that I'm from New York and I find the water quality here not as good as New York. It's the same thing that happened to me when I came in 2013. So I came from Miami and I found the water quality, let me just revive myself. The test of the tap water, not as good as Miami. And that's how me, Parvez, and I started to talk about this project in the beginning. We don't compare, and I think it needs to be compared because sometimes the argument in favor of not addressing the concerns of the citizens properly is there are so many people having no problem with the taste or they don't have any concern for the quality. And I believe it, to some extent, depends upon how long they are in Jacksonville. So they're just used to the taste of the water eventually. But when a person is coming from outside, it's hard for them to, drink it straight. And we haven't done it yet. As Russell and Parvez would agree, we have definitely resource constraint. So definitely once those things can be addressed properly in future, that's the plan.
So when you look at the facts on the ground that people in Jacksonville are spending a lot of money on bottled water, they're spending a lot of money on other ways in which they can make their drinking water more satisfactory towards their taste. With water, particularly with the taste and perception of water quality for drinking purposes, you can go through a lot of scientific tests and they're important for benchmarking and we have done that in our study. But at the end of the day, it's the public perception that matters the most because it's the most intimate thing you do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. You open your faucet and water comes out, you put it to your lips and you feel like, I don't want to drink this one. Or I'm going to spend some money. So right now, people are spending a lot of money on bottled water and they have
Is that anecdotal or is there data to show that?
There is study. I mean, we have, nationally, I think our study showed that people are spending in the billions of dollars. So Americans are spending in the billions, and it is not just with the expenses in terms of bottling the water, but they have environmental impacts. The plastic from the bottles, they don't get recycled, less than 15-20% of the bottle
studies,
get recycled.
Aren't there other studies to show that bottled water isn't necessarily purer or better than tap water?
Scientifically, it's not as better, but the perception is that the bottled water is better, so people are willing to spend that money. And they're spending more on bottled water than they would be spending if they would improve the perception of JEA's water.
Melissa, let me just give you a few numbers. Maybe you'll like it. So when the tap water quality is concerned, I believe it's EPA's regulation. When the bottled water is concerned, it's FDA's regulation because it's treated as food. Now, for lead, EPA said it has to be below for 10% of those samples and something like that, that their requirement is 15 ppb parts per billion. For FDA it's 5 ppb. So if you're saying I want quality, well, FDA's regulation is much strict than EPA. So as a consumer, if I have any concern for the tap water quality, I'll be saying FDA's regulation is much stricter, so it should be safer.
Okay,
let me just give you one more. Sodium fluoride, EPA, it's 4 mg per liter, I believe. FDA, it's 0.7 milligram per liter. So, when you are saying it's the same thing, well, I don't check it. I just see the restriction they have to go through, And I see for bottled water, the restriction is more.
Let me get some calls on the air. Okay. Lots of people waiting on hold. John in Bay Meadows. Hi, John. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, yes, I'd be willing to pay a little bit extra for clean water. However, I live in Bay Meadows, and if you take the tap water and you add bleach to it, you get a copious white precipitate. I'm wondering what this is. It can't be good. Has to be some sort of metal in the drinking water. So I'm wondering where I can send this to get analyzed.
All right. Thanks for that. Kevin Holbrook's JEA.
Yes, we'd be glad if you just call 665-6000. We'd be glad to come out to your house and test the water for you.
All right. Todd on the south side. Hey, Todd. Happy Monday.
No, thank you. I wanted to comment about the Environmental Working Group study, which I thought was a great disservice to Jacksonville. I served on our environmental board for many years as a volunteer, and we got the water reports every month. And I had several points to make. Yes, there are toxins in our water and in our foods, even arsenic, but at extremely low levels, levels where you'd have to drink hundreds of gallons of the water a week for your whole life to ever maybe have a toxicity. So the concept has to be remembered. A food or a water can contain a toxin and still be an extremely healthy food. Organic vegetables contain lots of toxins, but at such tiny levels, it doesn't matter. Our water is safe. What isn't safe, or isn't reliably safe, is bottled water because it's not tested with the same standards as our city water made by JEA. And more importantly, bottled water is a terrible environmental disaster. It takes 3 bottles of water to make 1 bottle of bottled water, plus all that plastic that has to be made from petroleum and the carbon costs and the recycling costs. So we shouldn't buy bottled water. We should support our municipal water supplies, support JEA, and make sure our water stays safe, right? Watching over JEA as the environmental board and the state government do.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. And I think that's why these professors embarked on this study to make those very points. Meanwhile, here's a comment on our Facebook page from Mitch. This is really the perception you're all fighting against, all four of you, really. He writes, I moved here from New York, and the water there is head and shoulders above the water here. I pay a lot more than $6 a month to buy bottled water. Of course, this is what you'd all like to avoid. So let's go to some calls. Keith in Riverside. Hi, Keith. Thanks for holding. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning. Yeah, we're talking about safe water, and I think we understand what safe water means. You know, I don't doubt that the water is safe, but do we have a baseline for what healthy water looks like? And you know, are we striving to meet to that baseline?
Thank you, Keith. What about that?
I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah. What's a ballpark baseline that the average JEA customer could grasp? I mean, how do you define that?
In what aspects?
In terms of safe to drink, safe to cook with?
Well, yeah. I mean, our water is obviously perfectly safe to drink, cook, and take baths and everything. It's highly tested. We're very fortunate here. I guess I should just start off with our source of water. We get our source for the Florida Aquifer, which is underneath us about 800 feet. All our wells are 800 feet. So it's groundwater. Now, this is a limestone aquifer. So for the people that have the precipitates and stuff, that's your calcium carbonate, which is what you fully expect out of a limestone aquifer. We do very minimal treatment on our water. So what you're drinking from the aquifer is essentially pure water. With the minerals included, magnesium, calcium, et cetera. But we literally pull it out of the ground, put it in an aeration basin to get rid of the sulfur odor, and then we add chlorine to it, which is required by law, and then pump it to your house.
Ann on the north side. Go ahead, Ann. Thanks for calling the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I am a New Yorker, and I do, unfortunately, I would be willing to pay far more than $6.
Man, all these transplanted New Yorkers have a lot to say about our water today. Go ahead, Ann. Yes. You're like the third or fourth New Yorker to contact us today.
My daughter and I moved here a year ago. We both started getting eczema. I cannot drink that water, and I cannot give it to her. And we drink predominantly water, as like just what we drink on a daily basis. And I have been devastated by the fact that not only am I buying this much bottled water, but also unable to recycle.
Would you be willing to use a filter in your water, like a filter in your refrigerator?
I would, and I have looked into getting a filtering system for all the water in my house because it not only impacts the water that we use for cooking, but it's impacting our skin using the water. So I don't know if I need to have my particular location tested, but I don't trust it even to brush my teeth, to be honest with you.
Okay. Thanks. Sorry to hear that. And thanks for the call, Anne. Anne on the north side, Dr. Triplett, one of the study authors. Go ahead.
Melissa, trust is a big part of what we're after in this study. And let me just mention a few more of our numbers to you. We recognize that people's behavior is influenced by their perceptions and by the information that is available, but also by their own preconceptions and biases that we all have. We asked our respondents how much trust they have in various levels of government and various government agencies. And JEA specifically, our respondents indicated that they had little or no trust. Almost 50% of our respondents answered in such a way. But JEA was not unique in that sense. When it came to the EPA, we had 48% of respondents say they had little or no trust. The city government, 62%. The state government, 63%. So what I think we're seeing here, at least in part, is this common distrust of institutions that we've observed in various forms over the past several years, and that perhaps manifested itself most recently in the 2016 election cycle. Mm-hmm. This is not just about JEA, we think, but about this common distrust of institutions.
We're skeptical of everything.
How to overcome that,
sure. Dr. Ahmed.
So what it does is that what this study provides is a mechanism for public policy. We see this at a level of distrust across broad swaths of government and public policy institutions. One of the ways to improve that public perception is through better communication, through better policymaking, and better involvement of citizens. I think this study provides a basis. This willingness to pay number, $6 a month in your bill, actually strengthens JEA's hand, strengthens city government's hand, to say that, well, we can use this pool of money to either directly affect the quality of water, but more importantly, perhaps the perception of that quality of water among people through better education, through better communication on what the water quality means to you, what is considered safe, what is considered healthy, and what are some of the things that are natural. For example, as was mentioned, that because the water comes from a limestone aquifer, certain amounts of things will be present in the water is unavoidable. But that has to be better communicated with residents.
Jose, waiting on hold from downtown. Hi, Jose. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm in the construction business, and we rebuild houses and things like that. And we install new filters, everything brand new. And within 6 months, that thing looks like old, solidified. I don't know if that's calcium or sodium. And that messed up all the filters that we install brand new. And I'm 100% sure that has to do with the water. And what's the reason why that solidifies so fast? I mean, it's not only on the north side. I live on the south side in the Bay Mirror area, and that's a nice area, and I have the same problem. So I'm thinking to install a water softener, and I don't drink it even if they pay me, because I used to live in Connecticut, and I got family in New York, and I drink that water from the faucet with no problem. But here, that taste is not good, and it messed up the shower head and everything. What's the reason why?
Okay, thanks, Jose.
That's my question.
No, that's exactly it. It's a calcium in your water. The calcium, magnesium, is the minerals, and they just settle out and they into your faucets and everything, especially in your little aerator screens. We recommend taking those out and cleaning them once in a while. Once again, that's a natural byproduct. Now, we get back to the health issue. A lot of people take calcium as a supplement. Everyone says, drink your milk, do this. There's a lot of naturally occurring calcium in your water. So, you know, once again, a good source for calcium and magnesium. As I said, taste is subjective. Taste and odor is very subjective. It varies from individual to individual. All the calls we've gotten from the New Yorkers and everything about the water's really bad here. I grew up here. The water tastes great to me. It's fine. I'm used to it. But the water in New York is highly treated. It's surface water. I'm sure, I don't have it in front of me, but I'm sure it costs a lot more. You know, our job at JA, or what we try to do on a day-to-day basis, is to provide the best tasting, best drinking, safety drinking water at the most cost-effective manner possible.
Well, given that the UNF study finds people would be willing to pay a little more, is that a finding JEA would react to?
It's great for discussion. Obviously, there's a lot more involved than, you know, $6. I don't know what $6 gets us, you know. And then, truthfully, a lot of our utility people, you know, people that have our utilities, $6, they probably want to keep it in their pocket. Another thing we'd have to look at. But we could do a lot more treatment at the plant. We could put in all new pipes in the utopian world, but we still aren't going to address the plumbing in people's houses, how often they use the water, and stuff like that. So I don't know if you could ever get there. And then individual tastes vary. So what is good for somebody may not be good enough for someone else, or vice versa.
Dr. Chatterjee, we'll close with you.
Kevin... just to address what you said, can you tell me what's the total number of households you are serving?
We have approximately 330,000 residents and businesses.
So times six, that's where it takes us to. And right now our sample size was 700. I believe in the study there is, because of our limitation, what we did, it was bias to the top. So basically we said maximum you can contribute was $15. And there were people who on the phone said, I would like to pay more than that. So actually, if we just take that top off, it might be even more than that. So it's a very good revenue that you can use in future if you want to, build up to the capacity, or more testing, or more treatments, or what you said is more intriguing to me is the pipelines. So you said I was looking at the website and it says, well, we have these pumping houses, we have this facility where we are treating the water, and then it's the pipelines. And there are some parts, especially, I was living in apartment complexes, certain complexes which are pretty old. I've seen I've tested the water. Those places that the water test is bad, really bad. I mean, it's from my personal experience. To be very truthful, I really don't doubt that it's harmful to my body. I don't think it's contaminated, really. I mean, I'm just opening my heart to you. I don't think I really think it's totally safe and people should trust it. But the issue is, I tried to drink it, I couldn't. I mean, I'm not saying it's contaminated. I'm just saying I'm unable to drink it. It just tastes bad and that's stopping me. And that's just me. There'll be many people, because of the taste, they'll just have this perception that, you know, there might be something wrong. And what the person said, and you said it's basically the hardness of the water.
Let me just say, $6 per person with their customers is a couple million dollars.
Right.
Is that really enough to, if skepticism is as great as it is,
so,
is that really going to move the needle? And that's why we're going to have to leave that question hanging. But here's what I propose, that you all come back and we revisit this issue again soon, okay. Because clearly this is one of great interest to all of our listeners. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Melissa.
The study authors, Dr. Chirdip Chatterjee, Dr. Russell Triplett, Dr. Parvez Ahmed of UNF, and Kevin Holbrooks with JEA. Gentlemen, we will keep covering this story. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Culpepper talks March Madness, but up next, why a certain type of cancer, kidney cancer, is on the rise. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Enterprise Florida, paving the way for a better tomorrow for Florida's children and grandchildren through job creation and economic prosperity. Glimpse into the future at FloridaTheFutureIsHere.com.
They say all politics is local, but state legislative news is really local. Laws from Tallahassee affect our everyday lives. That's why Florida public radio stations are teaming up with a preview of what's up for debate in this year's legislative session. Join us this week for in-depth coverage of education, healthcare, and environmental legislation, as well as proposed new gun laws. Decision Florida coverage during Morning Edition on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, boom, bust, and the travel ban. What's really going on?
Searches for San Diego were also down 43%, Las Vegas by 39%, and Los Angeles 32%.
Tourism is taking a hit, but hundreds of thousands of new jobs are still getting filled every month. The travel ban and America's bottom line, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, March is National Kidney Month, and it's important this month to spread awareness of kidney diseases, including kidney cancer. It's not the type of cancer that gets as much attention as others, but people need to be aware of symptoms and not delay in seeking medical treatment because this year alone, more than 64,000 kidney cancer cases are expected to be diagnosed, and Florida has the second highest number of anticipated new cases in the country. Seth Strope, MD, is a urologic oncologist surgeon and new head of urologic oncology at Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. So Florida lags only behind California in the number of cases. Is that because we have so many people living here, or are there other reasons?
I think it is twofold. I mean, yes, and also that, you know, the retiree population here in Florida is definitely a contributing factor. Kidney cancer incidence goes up with age, although we have been finding more kidney cancers in younger people as well. And that's been a finding that we've been seeing in the under 40 set as well.
Wow, so that's alarming.
To really keep in mind, yes.
And is that due to younger people, their lifestyle choices, smoking, obesity, things like that?
Those are the two biggest risk factors for kidney cancer. In the younger age group, probably less so smoking, because we have been seeing smoking rates decline over time, but obesity has been increasing, and that's the number one thing that we can probably connect to seeing for that increase in kidney cancer.
This isn't the type of cancer people lie awake at night worrying about, but it's one that people need to know about.
It is. The problem with kidney cancer is that it's silent. And so back before we had all of our imaging techniques and all those things that we have now, it used to be considered the internist tumor. People would have weird symptoms and say, what's going on? We really don't know. Now, most of the time we find kidney cancers because people get a pain somewhere in the body, they get a scan, an ultrasound, maybe they're getting an MRI for back pain, and it shows a mass. Mm-hmm. It's important to get that worked up the rest of the way to find out what's going on. Many are simple cysts that are not cancers and you don't have to worry about, but you want to make sure it's not something more concerning.
Sure. So warning signs are abdominal or back pain. As you said, blood in the urine, that's a big red flag.
Absolutely. And blood in the urine is a big red flag for kidney cancer, but also for bladder cancer and other things related to the kidneys, like kidney stones that can cause problems, maybe not to the severity of a cancer, but definitely, you know, in terms of National Kidney Month, to keep in mind as well.
Now, the new Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center has been a huge addition to our medical tourism picture here in Northeast Florida. People come from around the world to take advantage of our excellent doctors and centers. What is MD Anderson doing in terms of examining treatments and trials and different medications for this type of disease?
Fortunately, there's been a lot of progress in urologic oncology and for new medications coming out for these diseases. And with kidney cancer, we have a lot of targeted therapies that are being used. In addition, there's new immunotherapies that are coming out, and we're looking at using those earlier in the disease process, before we even perform the surgeries that remove the cancers. The point at which the immunotherapies may actually work best is when there's still something to treat, mm-hmm. raise the immune reaction against it, and get the cancer out after that.
The promise of immunotherapy just seems kind of mind-blowing. Are we on the kind of the leading edge of what it might reveal in terms of treating cancer?
We are. Immunotherapies have a lot of promise. We've been using them mostly so far in the setting of metastatic disease or disease that's gone to other places in the body. What we're really trying to do now is bring that to an earlier time point when it may actually have even more of an impact on care. And that's where some of the new trials are going on, some of the trials that we're trying to bring from MD Anderson in Texas over here to Jacksonville to really give patients the best care possible and the most integrated care possible.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. March is National Kidney Month, and so this is an important topic. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Seth Strope, he heads urologic oncology at Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center, and we'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, addictive technology, from our smartphones to immersive online games. We'll talk with Adam Alter, author of the new book, Irresistible, about how our digital devices are contributing to the rise of behavioral addictions, such as compulsive video game playing and online shopping. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Calling all artists, WJCT is celebrating 45 years on the radio, and we need your help to design the perfect anniversary t-shirt. Design should reflect what WJCT means to you or the First Coast community. The winning design will be featured on a limited edition t-shirt during our spring pledge drive. Get started now at wjct.org/45 years. Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
Welcome back. She's a local professor and mom, and now Trisha Booker is an author. She's out with her first book, and it's a personal account of her family's journey going through the process of international adoption. Trisha Booker joins us now with more about The Place of Peace and Crickets. Good morning.
Good morning.
What an intriguing title.
Thank you.
We'll hear what that means in a moment, but first, you decided to write about how you became a parent through adopting a child internationally. Your first child was born in Vietnam, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so you decided to adopt, and that was quite a process. And this is all in the book.
It is. It's all in the book, and it was quite a process. I call it an 11-month pregnancy because...
Oh, wow. It took a year to do the whole thing.
The first time, yeah. The first time it took a little over a year until we got her home, but you just could never imagine the paperwork involved, the hoops that you have to jump through, the diplomatic programs that you have to navigate in order to get a child home, and the angst that you feel because once you meet that child, and we did meet her before we could bring her home, leaving her back in the orphanage while you come home to wait is excruciating.
Oh, I can imagine. But you decided to keep going. You adopted two more children from Guatemala.
We did. The second child was a boy that we brought home, and he is my son who was eventually diagnosed with a form of reactive attachment disorder related to his adoption. He was in a place that was clean, and he had food, but he had very little human interaction for the first 7 months of his life.
And that can really impact a child's brain development, their psyche. So what was it like then when you brought him home?
When we brought him home, it was fine. I mean, he was a beautiful, healthy baby. But we noticed things that at the time didn't occur to us that it meant anything. Like, he would sleep in the morning. He would have been in his crib for 12 and 13 hours. And I'd go to check on him, and he's just laying there awake. And in hindsight, we know that that was because nobody ever came to him when he cried anyway. So he just
gave up.
He just gave up. And he grew up pretty healthy. When he was about 2 months, two years old, we started noticing tantrums that just weren't quite normal, that he was a little bit more reactive than the other kids, than other kids I had seen at that age. He just had more tantrums, and sometimes they were really violent.
Wow. It, to the point where you actually brought a service dog to your home to help your son.
Yes. When he was, I guess he was about eight. I mean, we were just grasping at straws. We had been through therapists, and we had been through psychiatrists and psychologists and doctors, and we were at our wit's end. Nobody knew what to do with this child, and frankly, nobody really understood what we were going through because most of his behavior was exhibited at home. I read an article about an autism assistance dog that just seemed magical to me, and I told my husband, that's what we need. We need a dog. We need to give our son a dog. And my husband was like, yeah, I don't really think that's the answer. But we did it anyway.
And it worked.
It helped. It helped a lot. Yeah. And we still have him. We call him Buddy the Wonder Dog. And he's pretty
How did
amazing.
The dog make an impact with your son in a way that all the other therapies couldn't?
Well, my son Nico needed comforting all the time. He needed something to hold on to all the time, when he was asleep, when he was awake, when he was out. So at night, he had something to curl up against. When we went out to eat at a restaurant and he started falling apart, he literally would crawl under the table and snuggle with the dog. It was kind of a touchstone for him to remind him that he was safe. And that, in the end, is what attachment disorder is all about. It's feeling safe where you are.
So the trauma that a child goes through, even if they're getting a basic amount of care in an overseas orphanage, when they go through the process of being adopted, what happens in those early months is so incredibly important, and it can have ramifications that last a lifetime. You experienced this as a mom firsthand, and the journey for you, it sounds as though, was excruciating at times too.
Absolutely. I mean, I never wanted to think that my children were impacted by those early months, but you're absolutely right. When you think, if you have biological children and you think of them laying in a crib for 7 months with 15 minutes of touch and being held a day, of course it's going to impact them. And yeah, as they grew up and we realized how unsafe they felt and how kind of emotionally drawn they were, it was really difficult to see their pain.
Yeah. So what then does the title of your book refer to, The Place of Peace and Crickets?
My son is so imaginative, and he is a really gentle soul when he is not having episodes, we call them, related to his anxiety disorder. One day he came up to me and he said, hey, Mom. He was about 7 years old, and he said, do you want me to take you to the place of peace and crickets? And I said, well, of course I do. And he took my hand and he led me outside, and he had set up these stations all around the outside of the yard. He said, here's where you listen to the crickets, Mom. And we were just quiet and we listened to crickets. And then he took me to another station and he said, Mom, I drew a peace sign here. See, here's peace. And then he took me to another place and he had a feather and he said, look, Mom, just feel the feather. And he rubbed it on my cheek. And it was just the most beautiful, peaceful thing that he had invented, this safe, peaceful spot for himself. It was just magic.
Oh, that's a magical anecdote from this book. And we're so lucky to have a local author like you here to share this story, because so many parents and children have had this journey, as you have.
You're going to be hosting several events to debut your first book, Tricia Booker. And the first one is Saturday night, March 18th, 7 p.m. at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach.
It is.
Yeah,
I've been friends with Rona for over 20 years, and I used to work at the Bookmark and dream of a day when I could read my own book there. And it's hard for me to believe that it has actually come true.
We're getting tweets about you, so I think you're going to get a really nice turnout. Here's a tweet from Julia. I'm listening to Tricia Booker talk about anxious attachment disorder right now. I can't wait to buy her book. The book is available online, where people can come out and see you Saturday night at the Bookmark and a few other events, too.
Absolutely. There'll be plenty of copies at the Bookmark, and thank you very much, Julia, for listening.
She's author Tricia Booker. Go see her Saturday night at the Bookmark. The new book is The Place of Peace and Crickets. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
The site of the 1559 settlement of Don Tristan de Luna has remained a mystery for more than 4.5 centuries. Archaeologists have now discovered the lost colony in a Pensacola neighborhood. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the site. We'll discuss some of Florida's first laws from 1845 and the 1968 Constitution. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2. Sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, get your brackets ready. March Madness is here.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper has all your sports news and notes, but before we talk about Florida schools, let me just say...
I know where you're going with this.
I am so excited that my alma mater, Northwestern University... is in the big dance this year. And by the way, did you see the video of Seinfeld star Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her husband, Brad Hall? They met at Northwestern. They were theater students there together several years before I went there. Their son, Charlie Hall, walked on and played in one of the games. Did you see that video?
That's
on ESPN?
Amazing.
And you could see them in the audience. They were so excited. They were clapping and cheering. It was cool.
You know, Northwestern is the only school of the major conferences that had never gone to the big dance.
That's right.
And now they finally get in. They've had their best season ever, and they will play in the first round against Vanderbilt in Salt Lake City on Thursday. And here in my bracket that I have in front of me, well, let's just say Northwestern will enjoy the ride.
Okay.
For one day. They have a shot. They have a shot to move on.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
For sure. And this is the time of year when everybody gathers around their brackets and finds that 5-12 upset. There's always a 12 seed that beats a 5 seed and moves on. And people talk about, is this the year that a number 1 seed will lose to a 16 seed? The answer is no. there are more teams that can probably win this tournament this year than in any time in the recent past that I can recall. It's a wide open year. No one dominant team, but the number 1 overall seed is Villanova, the defending champions, who you may recall beat North Carolina on a last-second jumper last year. Villanova, North Carolina, Gonzaga, and Kansas are the number 1 seeds. My alma mater, I'll pointed
out.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, hey, now you and I are rivals sort of here in
right,
a little bit
yes.
of a way.
Sure. This is the first time Northwestern's ever made it in, and Kansas has made it in a record 28 times, but it's a rivalry.
Not that you need
sure.
to rub that in
no,
or
just,
anything.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we used to chant at games. That's all right. That's okay. You're going to work for us someday.
And that, most of the time, that was true.
Not always, though, because no one's really working for me. But anyway, go ahead.
So let's talk about what Florida and Florida State have as far as what they need to deal with. Both are playing in Orlando and will play on Thursday. So if you're a area basketball fan, you can pop down to Orlando, watch both Florida and Florida State play on Thursday. FSU will take on Florida Gulf Coast, Dunk City,
oh, really?
Out of the Atlantic Sun, the A-Sun champions, who, of course, had that big run a couple of years ago before they lost to Florida. But FSU has one of their most talented teams they've had in years. I have Florida State going to the Elite Eight this year. But a lot of folks like Florida Gulf Coast as an upset pick because they've pulled upsets before. I don't see it happening this year against a very talented FSU team. Florida plays East Tennessee State in the first round. And I have FSU going to the Sweet 16, where they would face potentially the defending champions Villanova at that point. So it would be a pretty good run for the Gators, considering the where the expectations were when the season began.
And your bracket, you brought your brackets with you. They're
yes.
upside down as mm-hmm. I'm looking at them.
Yeah.
But as I'm reading your handwriting upside down, I see Duke, Kentucky, UCL.
No.
What do you got
so
here?
So you're talking Final Four?
Yeah.
I've got Duke, West Virginia.
As
a little bit of an upset pick. I have them beating Gonzaga to get all the way there, and then beating Florida State as well. UCLA and Kentucky. And Kansas,
yeah.
rather, as the in the finals.
And
for the 28th consecutive year,
Kansas.
I picked Kansas to win the championship.
All right, you heard it here first. You heard it here first from the great Cole Pepper. A few other sports news and notes. For the first time ever, Swisher Gym on the JU campus hosting a national postseason tournament game.
Yeah, tomorrow JU hosts St. Francis from Pennsylvania in the CIT, the College Invitational Tournament. This is the third tier of postseason tournaments, but it can offer a great chance for teams to get some additional experience. It's also only the second time that JU and St. Francis have ever met on the basketball court. They met back in 1980 at the Coliseum, for those who remember the Jacksonville Coliseum. JU won that game as well.
Jaguars
continue to be active in free agency. A flurry of activity that included signing four guys that would be starters, signed three and traded for one. Calais Campbell, the defensive end, cornerback A.J. Bowie, safety Barry Church all signed as free agents, and Brandon Albert traded from the Miami Dolphins. I think that there's more to come, by the way, for the Jaguars. They're hosting a couple of big-name players this week. Dontari Poe, the former first-round pick from Kansas City, and Latavius Murray, the running back who played his first three seasons in Oakland.
Last but not least, over 14,000 runners in the Gate River Run.
14,000 finished. Few more started.
Oh, okay. 14,000 finished.
Yeah,
I stand correct.
Yeah, there are some who didn't get it all the way to the end. That was not the case for 84-year-old Joe Blewett, who was the final finisher. He was the final of the over 14,000 to finish.
Oh, that's great.
The winners, Leonard Career and Jordan Hasse on the men's and women's side, now national champions. There was also a little bit of a political grudge match, tongue-in-cheek, when State Attorney Melissa Nelson challenged Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry. Curry stepped up his game, ran his best time ever, beating Nelson by nearly 14 minutes.
Oh, good for him. And that's our sports for today. Follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pepper. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. 1A's up next. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.